Good afternoon and welcome to the 482nd meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the forum has been meeting each month to hear from an invited speaker on an issue central to U.S. foreign policy. This month, we'll have two meetings. At today's meeting, we are pleased to have Ambassador Jeffrey Feltman here to speak on Adrift, the UN Multilateralism and U.S. Disengagement. Ambassador Jeffrey D. Feltman is the John C. Whitehead Visiting Fellow in International Diplomacy in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Prior to this position, he served in the UN Secretariat as the United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. As head of the United Nations Department of Political Affairs, he oversaw the UN's diplomatic efforts to prevent and mitigate conflict around the globe. Before joining the United Nations, Ambassador Feltman served as a foreign service officer. In his last posting, he was a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs with the rank of career minister. He was United States Ambassador to Lebanon from 2004 to 2008. Before becoming Ambassador to Lebanon, he worked in diplomatic positions in Iraq and Israel. He joined the U.S. Foreign Service in 1986, serving his first tour in Haiti. So he's really been around the world in a lot of places. He spent much of his career dealing with Eastern Europe and the Near East. Ambassador Feltman speaks Arabic, French, and Hungarian, and he also speaks English. I can confirm that for you. The speakers always leave
spoke,
that out.
Spoke, not it's an spoke, element past tense.
He received his undergraduate degree in history and fine arts from Ball State University in Indiana, and his master's degree in law and diplomacy from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Jeff, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think the more correct verb tense on those foreign languages would be Jeff spoke those languages. I really want to thank the Midcoast Forum for inviting me. This is a real honor, and it's an impressive group. When I looked at the website and saw the speakers, saw the number of activities, you know, I'm overwhelmed with just how active this is. I also think it's special today that we have five students from Oceanside who participate in the Model UN, because I'm going to be speaking mostly about the Model UN today. And for those of you. And I think that the forum and the Midcoast region of Maine more generally needs to prepare to make room for yet more exiles and deportees from Washington, given how beautiful it is and given how the wood chipper treatment is still underway in Washington. I'd like to start today by taking us back to a rainy day in mid-December 1971. People were gathered at the Pierre Hotel for a farewell luncheon for U Thant. U Thant was the outgoing Secretary General about to end his tenure. And on the dais with U Thant at this farewell tribute luncheon were Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Senator Frank Church, Pete Seeger, Jacques Cousteau, Arthur Goldberg, and get this, John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Goldberg, by the way, I had to look up. Goldberg was a Supreme Court justice who resigned his seat to become Lyndon Johnson's ambassador to the United Nations. There were 600 guests, including diplomats, peace activists, business titans, elected officials, diplomats, etc. Joan Baez sent a written tribute. Oscar Hammerstein's widow, Dorothy, Jackie Onassis, Walter Lippmann, various Rockefellers, the Woolworth Corporation, and others funded the luncheon. Yes, there were speeches, but Pete Seeger also sang Blown in the Wind, after which John Lennon asked to borrow his guitar. And it was the first public performance in the United States of Imagine 2 months after it had been released in the UK. And I have to thank my friend Thant Minh Thieu, who's the grandson of U Thant, for sharing his recollections and research into the lunch for those details. Now, the term of the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, ends on December 31st, 2026, a year and a half from now. And I think we can safely assume that his farewell will be more subdued. And this reflects not only his lackluster tenure, to be honest, as Secretary General, I'll get to that, but also the precipitous decline more generally of the UN stock. And I think we can assume that none of today's Supreme Court justices yearn to trade lifetime tenure to become President Trump's ambassador to the United Nations. You know, but it doesn't really matter if Beyonce doesn't sing farewell to Guterres. What should concern us more is that the UN no longer captures our imagination as a primary address for peacemaking. And this, too, is different from the past. And to take one example, the most dramatic example, it's largely overlooked in the history books in this country now. Kennedy and Khrushchev turned to Outhant and the UN to play leading roles in resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, of course, was the closest we've ever come to nuclear Armageddon. So I'd like to touch today on two themes. First, the crisis in the multilateral system with a focus on the United Nations. The crisis definitely predates the re-election of Donald Trump, but Trump seems inclined to deconstruct the global order that, you know, however imperfect it is, has contributed to the fact that for 80 years we haven't had another world war. And then second, what should our response to this crisis be? You know, because defending a tired status quo, it's not going to inspire anybody. And we should question whether institutions that were established decades ago remain relevant in a world of dramatically different political, economical, technological, environmental, and demographic realities. But so far, through what I would describe as three eras, the Cold War, the post-Cold War period where sort of a unipolar moment, and then the emerging great power competition and multipolarity that we have now. Through those three eras, the institutions and alliances that were developed after World War II have survived and evolved. You know, NATO celebrated its 75th birthday last year. The UN Charter was signed in San Francisco 80 years ago this month. The Schuman Plan that created the momentum for European integration and led to the European Union was tabled 75 years ago. These institutions and others have endured, but I'm not sure that will remain the case. What we've known as the global order is now under an existential threat, and it's an existential threat coming from many different directions. I'm going to concentrate mostly on the American side. The Trump administration does not see value in our role, in our traditional role, is what I could call more or less a benevolent hegemon, but leans instead toward great power predatory policies. And this is not an erosion of U.S. leadership, it's a revision of the America's place in the globe. And I've heard from administrating insiders that even the word multilateralism has joined diversity as being unacceptably woke. And let me be clear, my defense today of the multilateral system is not rooted in some romantic notion about the UN or about multilateralism. For 6 years, I was the highest ranking US citizen inside the UN Secretariat, so I saw the institution from the inside, and I don't have any romance about it. I was telling the board members last night at the reception that Mika and Todd kindly hosted that working for the UN taught me how nimble and flexible the US State Department is. And for the other graduates of the State Department that are here, I think you understand what that means. And I was recently accused by a White House staffer as being part of a group of, quote, failed globalists. And so perhaps it's predictable, since I'm a failed globalist, that I do believe that the multilateral system that we've inherited has overall been a force multiplier for US interests, which is not surprising, since the United States shaped the overlapping institutions, alliances, and treaties that make up the global order. I mean, we baked our interests and our values into the system. And the multilateral system has expanded greatly, particularly since the end of the Cold War. But the United States has been the primary architect, the primary steward, and I believe the primary beneficiary. Now, of course, we've not always followed the system's rules, the system's norms. There's an underlying paradox that the United States has always been ambivalent about the international order that we, more than any other country, created and led. This uneasy relationship between Washington and the United Nations rests on an American willingness to constrain some of our immense power in the name of global cooperation that we cannot always control. And there's frequently, of course, a gap between what we claim to be and what we're actually doing. It's a phenomenon not confined to the United States, but our actions can have global implications. And like many of you here today, my career largely overlapped with that post-Cold War period, the unipolar moment when Russia was focused internally and China had not yet asserted its power. A time when the United States could largely set the international agenda unchallenged, when the U.S. encouraged the UN to help end wars in Central America, in Asia, in Africa, and elsewhere. And perhaps without even realizing it, we came to assume that this was the natural, permanent state of affairs, that the United States would unilaterally set the agenda for the world indefinitely. Now, the rest of the world had different ideas. And then entered Donald Trump, suspicious of the entire global order. And that brings me to the first theme, that background brings me to the first theme of my talk, the crisis in the United Nations and the multilateral system. Now, if you ask anyone in the United Nations, you will find consensus that the system is in crisis. Even if Trump is lighting a match to burn down the entire global architecture, everyone also acknowledges that the crisis predates his re-election. But you're not going to find consensus on what is the crisis, or when did the crisis start? Was it George Bush's decision to invade Iraq without Security Council authorization? Vladimir Putin's attempts to steal the territory of fellow UN member states by force? The global inequities that were revealed starkly by the COVID response, the persistent failure to address the climate catastrophe or the burdens of the global, or the debt burdens of the global south. Maybe it was UN ineffectiveness in conflict resolution from Gaza to Sudan to Ukraine to Myanmar and beyond. The UN's financial crisis. You know, the contrast between the challenges that require a global response and national policies that stoke division. It's a long list of what this crisis could be. But if there were a Venn diagram of all these crisis definitions, the overlap would be the Security Council. Russia blocks Security Council action on Ukraine, US vetoes Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, China uses its muscle to block Security Council scrutiny of what's happening in Myanmar. The three African countries on the Council don't have veto power, but they will unite and persuade other Council members to divert their eyes away from conflicts in Africa. So in other words, individual members of the Security Council who have the responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security bestowed on them by the Charter are instead actively blocking action and preventing information from being shared in Council settings. And then there's the issue of Council membership, which hasn't changed since the Council expanded from 11 to 15 members in 1965. Now, no one's going to publicly object to the general idea of membership reform. But imagine trying to get 193 member states to agree on what those changes should be, and then their national governments or legislatures to ratify them. In other words, don't hold your breath. And then there's the weak leadership of the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. It's rarely discussed publicly, but it adds to the sense of a rudderless United Nations. You know, in fairness to Guterres, for whom I worked for a year and a half of my 6 years, he faced what you might call the four horsemen of the multilateral apocalypse: COVID, Ukraine, Trump, and Gaza. You know, and these would have challenged the most forceful Secretary General, but Guterres has been AWOL on so many issues where the UN should have and could have been front and center. And then there's the Trump factor. I was in meetings with Guterres and President Trump during President Trump's first term when I was still at the United Nations. And curiously, the president himself does not seem to harbor the same intense animosity toward the UN that he does toward, say, the European Union. You know, maybe it's the appeal of the global stage that he likes speaking from that podium. He seemed in his first term to enjoy hosting the Security Council members for lunch at the White House and meetings with Guterres in the Oval Office. Biden, by the way, never invited Guterres to the Oval Office. The first time since the UN was founded that the President of the United States did not have the Secretary General in the Oval Office. And Trump also mentions quite fairly frequently the, quote, great potential of the UN. But nevertheless, the Trump administration proposes zeroing out contributions to the United Nations in favor of a $2.1 billion America First Opportunities Fund from which you could draw support for the United Nations depending on the proposal. By comparison, in 2023, the United States contributed $13 billion to the UN. 24% of that were mandatory contributions, the assessed contributions for the regular budget for peacekeeping, and 76% of that was for humanitarian development, other voluntary programs. And incidentally, even while the U.S. budget proposal envisages zeroing out funds for peacekeeping, on May 8th, the acting U.S. ambassador to the UN pushed the Security Council members to renew the peacekeeping mandate for the peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, a mission that cost $1.3 billion, of which the U.S. should be paying a little bit over a quarter for that. I mean, consistency is not always valued in any administration, but that's a particularly stark example. Zero out the peacekeeping budget while pushing for the mandate renewal for one of the peacekeeping missions. And the contrast I find, one of the contrasts I find striking is the reaction of the world to the first Trump administration's questions about multilaterals in the UN and now. In the first Trump administration, you had a surge of funding from European countries for humanitarian development, population, other work to compensate somewhat for US budget cuts. France and Germany put together this initiative called the Alliance for Multilateralism. It was much ballyhooed at the time. There were all sorts of summits and meetings about how to support the UN and multilateralism. This time, no one is leaping to rescue the UN. European countries are focused on increasing their own defense spending and finding resources for Ukraine. They're not going to be able to compensate for the US budget cuts. Parallel institutions like the BRICS, which for years was mostly a talk shop, and I went to BRICS summits for the UN, I saw this. But they've now developed secretariats. They're becoming more institutionally effective, meaning that center of gravity in the multilateral system that's the United Nations becomes somewhat less important as other institutions become institutionally effective. So if I were going to pick just one word to describe the crisis affecting multilateralism today, I'd pick indifference. The UN, the other institutions are vehicles. They're platforms, they're mechanisms. If countries do not use them, they lose their value. And that takes me to the second part of my talk. What our response should be. You know, the financial crisis that the UN's experiencing, combined with that indifference that I described, should prompt us to rethink what is essential about the United Nations. To identify what we can't afford to lose, what can't be done by coalitions of states elsewhere. And unexpectedly, I find myself sympathetic to the Trump administration's admonishments that the UN should, quote, go back to basics. This is after a vast expansion of its activities and its costs after the end of the Cold War. Yet I'm also convinced that my idea of going back to basics differs quite significantly from what the administration's views of going back to basics means. I think the Trump administration probably wants to drop any commitments for global health, development, climate mitigation, things like that, which I think are very, very important, but don't always have to be done by the UN itself. What I mean is that we focus on how to revive the peace and security role for the UN, which was, after all, created in the aftermath of two world wars in order to prevent a third world war. And the peace and the security work of the United Nations is centered in the Security Council. So, despite my earlier criticism of the Security Council, I think the Trump administration can and actually has an interest in reviving the Security Council, and let me give three reasons. First, I think that although thankfully the bromance between Trump and Putin seems to be cooling somewhat, even marginally improved Russian-US cooperation can unlock the current Security Council paralysis and can put China on notice that perhaps its junior partner in Moscow is less reliable than assumed. And Trump does talk of peace. He is willing to break taboos about talking to adversaries. Imagine if Trump could take credit for making the Security Council great again. But second, President Trump favors deals to end the war in Ukraine, the wars in the Middle East. He's eager for an agreement with Iran. Now, if he accomplishes any of these things, the proposed results are probably going to be controversial. They're probably not going to be liked by all countries or all people. And the UN Security Council is the only mechanism in the world that can make the terms universally applicable and legitimate. And if there are monitoring verification requirements to any of these, the UN Security Council has a globally accepted way of burden sharing in terms of costs, in terms of responsibilities, that this administration might find useful. It costs about 1/8 the cost of deploying a U.S. soldier or diplomat to deploy a U.N. peacekeeper or observer, 1/8, and we're only responsible for about 1/4 of that. But my third reason advocating for the Security Council, the most important in my mind, derives from the fact that whatever else it may do, the U.N. was created to prevent another world war. And the three countries that have the power and the reach to be implicated in a third world war are already on the Council. China, the Russian Federation, and the United States are the only countries that can determine whether local or regional conflicts will be contained or inflamed, whether great power competition and conflict between them can be managed or will spiral into a global conflagration. Yeah, undoubtedly, the Council's legitimacy would be improved if the membership were updated. But the countries we most need on the Council for its basic purpose are already there. But unfortunately, they don't seem to be turning to the UN and the Council in the same way that the United States and the Soviet Union did during the Cold War. Moscow and Washington seem to have lost their muscle memory. Yes, then the Council was paralyzed during the Cold War on many of its official business. But unlike now, the two adversaries also used the UN and the Council as platforms to create off-ramps, to build guardrails, to develop and accept face-saving initiatives. You know, during the decolonization wave that swept over the globe during the Cold War, the UN became the tool that both sides used in preventing those awful proxy wars from metastasizing into global war. Of course, I mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis earlier as the most dramatic example. And think about tensions with China. In an atmosphere of trade wars, decoupling, rhetorical bluster, close calls between the U.S. and the Chinese military in the Pacific, close calls that are inevitable, become more dangerous. And routine Security Council meetings provide a venue for exchanges that won't necessarily resolve the differences between Beijing and Moscow and Washington, but they can convey intentions, test ideas, and prevent miscalculations that could spark a devastating war. So even while the debate continues about how do we update the Security Council membership so the Security Council looks more like today's world than 1945's world, Washington, Beijing, and Moscow should use the Council for more than the polemical public point scoring that they do now. We saw an example last fall of how regularly scheduled meetings can lead to a lowering of tension. Xi Jinping and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met on the margins of the BRICS summit in Kazan, Russia last fall, And the BRICS, of course, did not resolve the Indian-Chinese border dispute, but the platform facilitated face-saving de-escalation. But how to get Washington, Beijing, and Moscow to use the Council platform? I have one idea. Let's force the Council to listen to those briefings that are currently being blocked, to get the U.S., Russian, Chinese representatives to discuss issues, the discussions that don't necessarily trigger the same polarization that Ukraine and Gaza might. And how? The General Assembly can help. Now, as an American, I find General Assembly grandstanding to be tiresome. But in 2022, the General Assembly created a useful precedent by adopting a resolution that forces a permanent member to appear before the General Assembly every time it vetoes a resolution in the Security Council. Now, that doesn't dilute or override the veto, but it changed the rules of the game, and it provides some accountability to the membership as a whole. So what if the GA similarly passed a resolution that it's not linked to any specific conflict today, but that would require, based on certain metrics, such as numbers of displaced, numbers of casualties, that would force the Secretary General or his representative to brief the Council. So it's no longer a question of the Council blocking the discussion. It's that the General Assembly would say, if this happens, then there'll be a briefing to the Security Council. That would bring Council members together and create some of the opportunities that the Soviets and Americans seized during the Cold War. Some of you may say, well, why bother with the Security Council at all at this point, given how polarized it is and given the failures to resolve conflicts that I've described earlier? But in today's polarized environment, global North versus Global South, East versus West, America versus Europe, we're not going to be able to recreate a better United Nations from scratch. The 50 members who signed the charter in San Francisco 80 years ago this month had the shared trauma of two world wars. The current 193 member states have widely divergent views about what is the most important role for the international institutions. So I think it's just wishful thinking to believe that we can have a new San Francisco moment in this environment. Now, in that post-Cold War unipolar moment, much was achieved. There was a decline in global poverty, there was disease reduction, there was cooperation on counterterrorism, many other areas. But still, were we too ambitious in times? Did we encourage the UN to take on too many tasks that we might have been able to do through other coalitions and that raised unrealistic expectations about the UN? Have we, as part of our disappointment with the UN, that we created expectations that were impossible for any organization to meet? And we should constantly take a sober look at our alliances and our memberships to see what is vital and what is not. Let me take one example. Do I, Jeff Feltman, think that UNESCO, the UN's Education, Science, and Culture Organization, is useful? Yes, I do. And will I regret a Trump administration decision to withdraw from it, as I expect is inevitable when the announced 90-day review is concluded, if there's actually a review going on at all? Yes, I'll regret it. But if I'm honest, UNESCO is not essential to our national security interests. And nor will UNESCO collapse without U.S. participation. But the Security Council, on the other hand, is irreplaceable. It provides a truly unique platform for exchanges. It has the power to create international law and universal obligations that no other body can. And we have the veto power to protect our interests. But the Security Council only works if the great powers utilize it as a firebreak against global conflict. As you all know, wars are raging in parts of the Middle East, Africa, and Central Europe. Tensions are rising in the South China Sea. Advances in technology and ecological catastrophes can hypercharge disputes. We could be on the threshold of a new nuclear arms race. In other words, we're closer to the conditions for World War III than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and perhaps since the signing of the Charter. But the good news is that the countries we most need to prevent World War III are already on the Council. Now, I opened with an anecdote from 1971, the Pierre Hotel tribute luncheon for U Thant. Let me close with two quotes from Harry Truman to reinforce the point that preventing World War III is at the essence of the United Nations creation. In October 1946, at the opening session of the Second General Assembly, the first General Assembly was held in London. The Second General Assembly was the first one held in the United States at Flushing Meadow in New York before the building of the UN headquarters. Anyway, at that session, in a speech, Truman said that, quote, another world war would shatter the hopes of mankind and completely destroy civilization as we know it. And a few months earlier, in May, Truman wrote a personal note. This is a note he wrote in the middle of the negotiations in San Francisco regarding the charter, regarding the UN charter. He said that he was deploying Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins was an envoy he had inherited from Franklin Roosevelt. He was deploying Harry Hopkins to Moscow, quote, to make it clear to Uncle Joe Stalin that I know what I want, and I intend to get it about the UN. Peace for the world for at least 90 years. Now, the UN, that was 80 years ago. The UN's already 80 years old. We need to extend that timeline beyond 10 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Believe it or not, your conclusions are more optimistic than a lot of the conclusions we have here by our speakers. While we're collecting questions from people here today, I always take the opportunity to ask the first question. It occurred to me as you were speaking about the question of how much emphasis this administration might or might not give to the UN. Is there any significance to the fact we're 4.5 months into the administration and don't yet have a perm rep? And that the rumors are that multilateral organizations are going to be defunded almost entirely?
What's interesting is there was not the same attempts to dismantle U.S. participation across the board in the United Nations as there was to dismantle, say, the U.S. soft power tools that we've referred to, AID, the Wilson Center, et cetera. Now, is that simply because they haven't gotten to it yet? Or is it because, as I suspect, I think that President Trump kind of likes that stage, you know, that we are the most important member of the United Nations, and the whole world is there when he addresses them at the General Assembly. I was there for his first address to the General Assembly back in 2017. He met with the Secretary General just after that, after his speech. I was in the meeting, and you could tell that the President liked the venue, liked that. And so I just suspect that there's not the same overt hostility. There's suspicion. There's skepticism. But there's not the same overt hostility to the UN in principle. Now, what the UN does in terms of population, development, climate, I would think there is hostility on that. And we're going to have to figure out how we build coalitions of countries, business, civil society to deal with things like climate, to deal with some of the issues that the Trump administration is not going to fund at the UN. But I'm hoping that they will see that there's value in preserving what can't be replaced. And I see that as the Security Council.
There's a question about the role of the Secretary General. What power does he or she have that they're not taking advantage of now? You mentioned that they're being...
Okay. Article 99 of the Charter gives the Secretary General the right or the responsibility to brief the Security Council on any issue that he sees that could provide a threat to international peace and security. Very few secretary generals have cited Article 99, have used this power because they do not want to cause a problem with member states. You know, that if the Secretary General says I'm going to under Article 99 brief you on what's happening in Myanmar because Myanmar is not on your agenda, then China is going to come down hard on him. And so the Secretary Generals, unless they have strong backbone, tend to avoid using Article 99. I think which is why I think that my modest proposal about making the GA devise a metric that would prompt a Secretary General briefing, I think would be useful because it would overcome the hesitation to use Article 99. But let me use another example of this Secretary General. He got crosswise with the Biden administration in December 2023 after the you know, unspeakable, horrific massacres in Israel on October 7th by Hamas. When in December 2023, he went to Rafah on the Egyptian side of the Egyptian-Gaza border, and he demanded that the Israelis allow humanitarian assistance into Gaza. I think that was entirely appropriate. Biden administration was uncomfortable with that because the Biden administration saw it as also poking fingers at them for not having accomplished it themselves. But I think it was entirely appropriate that the Secretary General demanded that the Israelis allow life-saving humanitarian assistance into a civilian population. But why did he never go to the border between Chad and Sudan? There were more people dying of starvation, food insecurity in Sudan when the Sudanese Armed Forces was preventing the UN from bringing food. And he never said anything about Sudan. He never went to the border. The same thing with the November 2020 to November 2022 Tigray War in northern Ethiopia. 600,000 people died in that war, many of them from starvation because of intentional blockage of humanitarian assistance. The Secretary General never went to the borders of Tigray and say, open that border. Those are the two areas that I would put at the top of my list where the UN could have played a stronger role. The Secretary General could have played a stronger role because it didn't cross the great power politics divide between Moscow, Washington, and Beijing, and he didn't.
Somebody wants to know if you could think of an example where a country actually does use the UN effectively. Or is it just impossible to do, no matter who you are or what you're doing?
It depends on the issue you're talking about. But since I was focused on peace and security, let me stick with that one for a while. I don't necessarily like what they've done all the time, but I think the African countries have done a really good job of protecting what they would see as their interests in the Security Council despite not having a veto. Now that blocks the Security Council scrutiny from some of the Africa conflicts, but you have to admit that they've been effective. The way you get something on the Security Council agenda is you need 9 votes, there's no veto. So the US could say, hey, there's a problem in Ethiopia. Ethiopia is not already on the agenda. And the Africans will say, we'll solve that ourselves. African solutions for African problems. And they will be able to come up with 7 members of the Security Council to block the Security Council from having any kind of discussion on that. So they've been very effective. Now, on the positive side, there were some of the European countries like Sweden, the Netherlands, Germany, during their time on the Council, were able to work with the rest of the elected 10. You know, as you all know, there's 5 permanent members, and there's elected 10 that are elected for 2-year terms. And some of the European countries in recent years have built a stronger coalition of the entire elected 10 in order to give the elected 10 more power against the P5. So I think that's been very effective. Now, I also think that China has been effective more generally, but not in a way that serves our interests, that China pays a lot more attention to we talked about this last night at the reception, to how things are worded, and it inserts languages that basically distorts resolutions and turns them into something else, more China-specific, rather than the U.S. values and interests that I mentioned were baked into the system.
A couple of related questions. One is, and let me read them both. One is, why has the UN only approved 1 new peacekeeping mission
since 2014?
And the other is, why do we keep funding peacekeeping missions such as the one in Congo, where there's been little progress in 25 years? So should we fund some new ones instead of old ones?
About 10 years ago, the peacekeeping budget was about $7.6 billion a year. And the humanitarian budget, but the humanitarian efforts of the UN were about $9 billion a year, about 10 years ago. In 2023, which is the last year that I've seen final figures, peacekeeping was down to $5.6 billion. And humanitarian was up to $35 billion. And that was not even reaching the total amount of the appeals. So there's already been a decline in peacekeeping. In terms of the expenditures for it, and there's been a decline in the confidence of host states to have peacekeeping. So I think that peacekeeping remains useful in the toolbox, but I don't think you're going to see many more billion-dollar peacekeeping missions like you had in the Congo or in South Sudan. I mean, we saw the Malians kicked out their peacekeeping. So I think it's useful to have it. I don't think it's going to be utilized that much.
How effective has it been?
I think that you could say that countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, there are a lot of countries where Nepal, Timor-Leste, there are a lot of places where you can cite positive progress in stabilizing the situation so that local authorities could take over security and governance. Cambodia is another example. And then if you wanted to argue the other way, you would look at the DRC. That it's a mixed bag. And I don't think that should be surprising.
Then you mentioned humanitarian programs, and what do you see as the value of the UN, both in humanitarian and human rights issues?
I mean, the U.S. traditionally supports about 40% of the UN's humanitarian expenditures, 30 to 40%. And now that's all been eliminated. Secretary Rubio says that there still will be some life-saving humanitarian assistance, but he hasn't said it would go back through the UN efforts. On the one hand, I think that the UN has developed mechanisms, systems for delivery under tough circumstances. The rules for UN staff going out to dangerous situations are far more flexible than the State Department's, for example, or AIDs, that they can get into conflict situations much more easily than the U.S. can by itself. So they've been a good vehicle for us to get assistance to people in need where we would not be able to go ourselves. But the trouble is that the UN, being a member state-driven organization, is beholden to sovereignty. If the claimants to Sudanese sovereignty in Port Sudan say, UN, you cannot deliver humanitarian assistance to Darfur, even though the authorities in Port Sudan do not have control over Darfur, the UN says, oh, okay, we can't violate state sovereignty. So on the one hand, they take more risk in terms of the dangers of delivering. On the other hand, the UN does not take political risk and say, we don't care about your sovereignty. Those people are dying. They need assistance. No, they will defer to the sovereign decision of claimants. And if you have countries, as we have in many places, that don't control all their territory but are nominally represent the sovereignty, that's a problem. Sudan, Ethiopia, Myanmar, the list is long.
Well, then, while we're on this general type theme, how about Gaza? Should the UN be more forceful in assuring an adequate role of food and medical supplies, or do they really?
The U.S. should be more forceful. The UN is not going to be able to force open the gates of Gaza, and the UN for a long history. I mean, Mika served in Jerusalem. The UN, well before October 7th, had a terrible reputation with the Israelis. That's worth a whole different subject. But in terms of getting life-saving humanitarian assistance into Gaza, they have the capability to do it. They just aren't allowed to do it, and they're not going to be able to persuade Netanyahu and his extremist cabinet to let them in. It would have to be the United States, and I don't see that happening.
Okay. Good answer. And kind of building on a theme that you had in your talk, if the international community remains indifferent to the UN, as you said they are, will any reforms make a difference?
We need to reignite excitement about the fact that this organization exists. Imagine trying to put this together today with all the stuff. It's sort of a miracle that we have it, it's still there. So how can we use it in a positive way, despite all of its flaws and all that? Well, I was Secretary General. I think my disappointment. My former boss Guterres is great fun to be with. He's a great raconteur, but I don't think he's been a very effective leader of the United Nations. But his term ends a year and a half from now. There's already talk of who the next Secretary General is going to be. Supposedly, in this informal rotation, it's supposed to come from Latin America and Caribbean area, but that's not written in stone, so it may not happen that way. But the way that the Secretary General is appointed is as follows. The charter says the General Assembly, so the group with all 193 member states, shall appoint the Secretary General upon the recommendation of the Security Council. So it's actually the Security Council that picks the Secretary General and says, okay, GA, George is our candidate, and then the GA appoints him. What if the GA passed a resolution? I mean, I can't believe I'm looking to the General Assembly to save us on these things. But what if the GA passed a resolution and said, okay, Security Council, we want more than one candidate. And you suddenly have a real election. It would capture, I think most of us that follow international affairs, it would capture our imagination. So we want to watch. We want to see what happens. Now, none of those candidates, let's say it's two candidates, three candidates, none of them will be people that the United States can't stand because they would never get out of the Security Council in the first place. But it would make a different type of Secretary General appointment process that would gather attention to the UN and remind people, we've got this tool. How can we use it?
Then what qualities should we be seeking out of the next Secretary General?
Well, what we should be seeking is not what we will get. what we should be seeking is someone that's willing to shake things up and to speak, you know, the proverbial truth to power when it comes to peace and security matters. But do Washington, Beijing, Moscow, even London or Paris, want such an independent voice? They did not think they were going to get it with Kofi Annan. You know, they thought that Kofi Annan coming up from inside the system was going to be just a bland bureaucrat. And he turned out to be more than that. So what we need is not necessarily what we're going to get, but if they had to give more than one candidate, those candidates are going to have to appeal to the General Assembly in a way that so far they haven't had to do.
And you talked about the composition of the Security Council. Do you ever see a situation where one of the P5 members gets demoted in some way, or are we stuck with that forever? The specific question I had was, do you ever see Russia losing its permanent membership status? But I think it's a more general question.
I don't see Russia losing its permanent member status, and I don't want to see Russia lose its permanent member status, even though Russia has done more than any other country to undermine the very foundations of the UN Charter, the prohibition on acquiring territory of another member state by force. Because for the reasons I talked about before, is we want to prevent World War III, and this is a tool to prevent World War III, the Council. So I don't want to see Russia lose a seat. In terms of course, I think the British and the French fear very much that if there were real Security Council reform, that they could lose their seats, their veto power. I don't see that happening, but for the simple reason is that member states are never going to unite around one idea for Security Council reform. I love the idea of pushing it, because I love the idea of China facing a prospect that Japan and India have a good claim to be permanent members of the Security Council. How does Beijing say, well, no, we don't want that? So I like the idea, but I don't think we're going to see it happen, because there's so many divisions. You know, in Pakistan will get the Islamic world to block India. You know, there'll be all sorts of games to make sure that it never happens. But there is an inequity. Western Europe has 450 million people. And they always have four members of the Security Council, two permanent members, and then usually two others from the Western Europe and other group. Asia has 4.7 billion people, and they have fewer Security Council members than the West. So there is an inequity that that much of the world really resents.
As I listen to this, one of the questions that I think in my mind is, you talked about the fact that, at least in the previous term, President Trump talked about the great potential of the
U.S. Still talking about it.
What is the great potential? Do you have any idea what he means when he says that, or do you have your own views on what the potential of the organization really is in today's environment?
Well, again, I think that the UN has been one, not the only, cause reasons that we haven't had World War III. And so that, to me, is the greatest achievement of the creation of the UN and the UN as it has evolved, even while other parts of the UN have not had performance up to its potential. But in terms of Trump, I mean, he does seem to really want to avoid war. Let's hope that continues. And I think he sees the UN, with the US at its center, as being one of the tools to prevent war. And in that, I hope he's right.
Then, you know, how does the fact that the world is very multilateral, the whole, you know, the trade, the politics, all, how does that affect the operation of the UN? I mean, that's change over a period of time, and yet the UN is kind of static in the way it looks at things, or so it seems from the outside world.
Yeah, the UN is a bureaucratic morass, without question. And that's in part because you have 193 member states that are able to impose their own ideas onto how the system operates. So yes, it'd be nice to be able to just cut through all this stuff and reinvent the UN. But for the reasons I said, I don't think that's going to be possible. I forget what I'm sorry.
How multinationalism and the increase in multinationalism has really affected how they do or should operate.
Well, look, I think I focused my comments today on the United Nations because that's what I know best since I was in the belly of the beast for 6 years. But if you look at the multilateral system more generally, we have like a layered multilateralism. We have the UN, we have the IMF, we have the IBRD, NATO, the OECD. There's a whole, various treaties. There's a whole panoply of organizations, alliances, and treaties that have different purposes. They have different governing bodies. They have different memberships, but there's an overlap. And this works together to create the multilateral system that we've had. And now China is doing the same thing with the Asia Infrastructure Development Bank, with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So they are putting up their own layered multilateralism, I could say. And their layered multilateralism does not have those U.S. interests and values baked into it in the same way that the system that we've inherited from World War II does. But I don't think we're going. I firmly believe that we're going to continue to see the sort of layered multilateralism, not a single organization like the UN doing everything. And I think that that's probably healthy.
Then someone asked, does the UN have actually any financial leverage to influence policies or actions of individual countries through international commerce organizations?
Through international?
Like commerce organizations, through like the IMF and the World Bank. And what role does the UN then play in this whole financial?
Less than you probably would imagine. I mean, the IMF and the World Bank are Bretton Woods institutions. They're linked, but they have a far more important role than the sort of more centralized UN roles. You know, UNDP does not have as big of a role as the IMF and the World Bank have. But then you've got China coming in with things like the Asia Infrastructure Development Bank, with even more capital, with more influence. You know, I mentioned in the remarks that I see the UN as having evolved through three eras, that Cold War period, the post-Cold War unipolar moment, and then now, whatever we call it today. But the Global South, so-called, you know, using that term liberally, they see the UN as they see different eras. They don't divide it the way that we divide it. They see the decolonization period as being the most important part, and they see that as the UN as being evidence that they emerged sovereign, that the UN for them is a symbol of their sovereignty.
Then I want to close with a couple of questions that are more general in nature. One is, what actions can we as citizens do to promote the UN and its mission? We're informed, but how can we act? What can we do if we're informed and want to do something to build support for the UN?
It's a good question. I mean, there's the traditional stuff that you know, we can always write to our congressional representatives. You have two quite interesting senators here, things like that. But I would say, you know, the fact that you're highlighting the model UN, that you're helping the next generation understand why this institution is important, so that the next generation recognizes they have no memory of the Cuban, you know, I hardly have a memory of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but they have no memory of why these institutions exist, and I'm delighted that they are working on them. But I'd say play up the next generation's model UN experience, things like that, so that they stay invested.
And then let's talk about the future then. So we educate them now. And this is the second question. You've answered it pretty much already, but what can the youth who have joined us today do to promote the UN? I mean, other than to participate in the model UN, is there career paths they should take, or there?
Well, I was mentioning to one of the students that when I was at the UN, that many of my colleagues and people who worked for me had come out of model UNs, and not just in the United States, model UNs in Africa, model UNs in Eastern Europe. And they had acquired an appreciation for the cooperation, that the cooperation to meet shared challenges that the model UN programs or their equivalents elsewhere provided. And so that was kind of inspiring to realize that they had carried the Model UN experience all the way through their education. You had to have a master's to work in the UN Secretariat, so all the way through higher education and into the UN itself. I'm really alarmed that so many of the challenges that we face are transnational, that require us to look beyond our own country. And yet, our politics and politics elsewhere promote division and transaction. They don't promote cooperation. Even though the challenges, whether it's pandemic or AI or climate, can't be solved just in one country. It requires requires international cooperation. And these students, by understanding through the Model UN what can be done through cooperation, maybe will be able to reverse this inward look that we currently have.
Well, that's a very positive note to end on, which I like to do. So thank you very, very much.